Hi, I'm Michael Feinstein. My guest today is an award-winning violinist and composer, Mark O'Connor. With musical roots in bluegrass as well as jazz and classical training, his music has shaped an entirely American school of string playing. His score, Fiddle Concerto, is the most performed violin concerto composed in the last 40 years. He has won 2 Grammy Awards and has performed with everyone from Yo-Yo Ma to Dolly Parton. Mark O'Connor, welcome to Song Travels.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Michael.
It's my pleasure, truly. I so admire the scope and breadth of your music. It's one of the most dazzling things to me, and it seems like you have been able to accomplish practically any sort of musical idea that you've conceived. Would that be accurate?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that's why I like to refer to myself as an American musician, because we have so much here on the American music scene that I wanted to be a part of. And I wanted the violin to be a part of it right from the very beginning. I wanted the violin to be a part of the blues and the ragtime and, you know, great songs and different, you know, musical genres. And I've been able to take the violin pretty far, I guess.
I'll say, how did you first come to the violin?
Well, guitar was my first instrument, and my mother wanted me to follow in the path of Segovia, which was the great classical guitarist. And I loved guitar. I was very good at it as a young student.
Were you studying classical guitar? What about pop?
Classical guitar in the beginning, and then I added flamenco guitar. But it wasn't until I was 11 that I saw the violin being played on television. And I saw 3 different styled players on one show on PBS, Itzhak Perlman, the great classical violinist, Jean-Luc Ponty, the fabulous jazz violinist, and the Ragin' Cajun, Doug Kershaw, who was tearing up the fiddle. And I turned to my mother and I said, I want to do all of that. And so she was hoping that I would continue to concentrate on the guitar. We put so much time into it. And I begged for 3 years to get a violin from my parents. They just couldn't afford one, and, you know, beyond that, you know, instruction. But I finally convinced my mother to get me a cheap fiddle, and I just took off on it. And I started meeting people, they started teaching me, and here I sit.
That's amazing. I want to know more about that, but I'd like to get to some music, and I'd love to do something with you to start things off. Today is a very eclectic program musically, but we're actually going to start with what we now call the Great American Songbook. Fats Waller and Andy Razzeff, even though we're going to do this instrumentally, me at the piano, and you're doing a beautiful rendition of this, I predict. Ain't Misbehavin'.
I love Ain't Misbehavin'. I used to play it with my teacher, Stefan Grappelli.
Oh.
And so yeah, I look forward to doing it with you.
Just made me nervous. All right, here we go.
Thank you.
Ain't Misbehavin', written for the Connie's Hot Chocolates, I think, something like that, one of those musical reviews of the late 20s where African-American composers were writing a ubiquitous number of hits. Your mission, it seems to me, if that's not too strong of a word, but I don't think it is to bring the violin to kids and to bring it to the fore as an instrument that can accomplish many different things.
Yeah, I think it's been too long since people think of the violin only as a classical music instrument. It's got a great history, and I love Beethoven probably as much as anyone. But I also love American music, and I really wanted the violin and the fiddle to be a part of American culture today. Mm-hmm. It has been for hundreds of years. And so I wanted to dip into that rich repertoire and use it as pedagogy for young string students today.
So when did you conceive the idea of creating the Mark O'Connor method, which has been compared as sort of the millennium version of Suzuki, that this is another step forward?
I started running string camps when I was in my late 20s, about 30 years old, and I've held them for about 20 years. And through those string camps, I've had 5,000 different students, and I started thinking about the method, putting it together right from the very beginning. A lot of times when string students learn how to play proficiently, and they practice their scales, and they practice their minuets, they get into high school age and then college, then they first discover jazz or the idea that they could play in a country band or a hip-hop band or whatever it is that they would discover as an older musician. For string playing, it's often too late to make those transitions into other styles of music because you need to be able to be more creative, be able to improvise, be able to write music. And those things are not a part of violin lessons as we know them today. Mm. And so I wanted my method to use American music with a healthy dose of creativity and improvisation, even from the very beginning, in sequential steps, so children will be creative with their music.
Well, I would love for you to play something from the Mark O'Connor method that combines the, how do you say, pedagogy?
Yeah.
With instruction. You've taken all these largely traditional pieces and cloaked them in a delicious new fashion. You're going to do something that is a rag?
This is an old tune from about 1900. Rubber Dolly Reg is known by fiddlers and violinists all over, but its initial title was Creole Bells. And what's so fascinating about this tune is that it ended up being interpreted by Mississippi John Hurt and Ella Fitzgerald. A lot of the fiddlers in the Western swing tradition played it as backup and push. It went through all these name changes, which is so fascinating. But it really embodies the idea that music in America was shared between cultures and races and regions. And the best tunes traveled, just like your show does. And so I picked out some songs from my method to play for you that really embody this journey, this American journey.
Well, this is great. That's really what Song Travels is about. And it's perfect to take the former Creole Bells and perform it as the Rubber Dolly Rag. And you're going to be performing this with your accompanist, Melissa Tung. Here it is, Rubber Dolly Rag. Thank you. Rubber Dolly Rag, that's a very powerful little piece. And that's so energetic in that it gives you a sense of a certain era, but it has such life to it. It feels, in a different way, so contemporary.
That's why American music is great for the method, because our best songs are sort of indestructible. Like, you can add new chords to them, you can mm-hmm. change the tempo, you can add more verses, you can put on beginnings and endings, and it's still the song.
They live, yeah.
And they exist so differently with different folks. Mm. And so that's what I want, ultimately, is for students to feel an ownership to their music. This is not somebody else's music, this is your music.
Mm. When you talk about the foundation of American music, you go back to the 1600s with all the different styles. But of course, you have written about the gentleman who's considered to be the first songwriter, Stephen Collins Foster. And Stephen Foster has always been a fascinating figure to me as long as I've known about him. And I read what you had written about him, which amplified something that I had only known about slightly. I was told that later in his life, he became very aware of the African-American plight and wrote songs very sympathetically about them. But I was told that that happened relatively late in his career. And in reading what you wrote about him, it seems as if he had this ideal or this thought of really trying to create a bridge through a good part of his career.
And here's what led me to that. A lot of American music, the history of it is very mysterious. A lot of it is not written down. A lot of it can't be written down because it's oral history, and oral history is not for the academics. So you wouldn't be able to go to a university and really study what was Foster thinking. But I followed the musical phrase, and that led me to some more research. And I was so happy to discover this research because it was my feeling that, you know, a guy like Foster or his pals that he was playing with in the minstrel shows, they dedicated their entire musical life to basically African-American music. Sure, yeah, a lot of it was racist.
Stereotypical.
Stereotypical, very ugly. But when they played their instruments, they played well. The best musicians in New York were hired for those shows. They had to embody the style of music, the rhythm. You know, you can't just fake that. They were playing the music with a lot of heart, even though there was the ugly comedy. And I think Foster, to be able to spend, you know, 20, 25 years of his life basically emulating or copying or being inspired by music from another culture, at some level, I think he had to really love it. And I think it showed in his later pieces where he said, this is great stuff and I want to be great at it and I want to write songs and pieces and melodies that will last. And they'll remember me as a part of this journey of bringing in African-American music into the culture of New York City.
Hmm. You've included in the method one of his most familiar pieces, Old Folks at Home.
Yes, this is one of my most favorite melodies. And it was Antonin Dvorak's favorite melody as well from the American scene. He loved it. And it's got a great history with violin playing too.
Let's hear it, Old Folks at Home. Our guest, Mark O'Connor, with Melissa Tong at the piano.
Thank you.
There's something so compelling about Old Folks at Home, Mark O'Connor. The harmonic structure of it is one of the most contemporary pieces of its time, I would venture to say.
Yeah, the music was ahead of its time. It's harmonic movement through jazz chords many years before there was jazz music. I think of Foster as one of our great American music geniuses. He contributed so much to the instrumental aspects of our music, as well as the songs that he left us.
Well, one of the things about music, of course, is that it crosses all lines, all barriers. And there's a piece that you're going to do for us that is a polka, but it's of Mexican origin. This is an example of cross-culturalization at its finest.
It is fantastic. Yesusita on Chihuahua. And this is the original tune that an amazing composer out of Mexico, Cortez, wrote. And he wrote it during the Mexican Revolution. Pancho Villa was involved in all of that. And the Americans backed Pancho Villa.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of cross-cultural exchange organically down there on the Texas border. And a lot of the music during that time floated up into Texas. And a lot of the Texas musicians incorporated that music into their own ensembles. So that piece turned into a Jesse polka by the 1930s with the Western swing bands like Cliff Bruner. He had a radio show much like yours where he would introduce guests in Texas in the 1930s. And Jesse polka was his theme song.
Well, it's a delight to hear it. Our guest Mark O'Connor performing the Jesse polka. That was a wonderful piece, the Jesse Polka. There's more coming up in a moment with master violinist Mark O'Connor and pianist Melissa Tong. I'm Michael Feinstein, and this is Song Travels from NPR Music. Mark, you had talked about the foundation of your method being four different kinds of music. Would you explain that?
One of the things that I wanted to do in establishing what I'm calling now an American school of string playing is that it needed to have a foundation, it needed to have a history, a story. You know, it's easy to understand European classical music story. Bach is the founding father of counterpoint and Western harmony. So everything that happened after him can refer back to him. What is American music story? What happened before jazz, right? The string playing was there. It was the string playing of the violin and the banjo going back 400 years. And so the foundational aspects of American instrumental music I've determined through the method as being the hoedown, ragtime, blues, and spiritual. And everything that we play today on the American scene, whether it's jazz, rock and roll, hip-hop, country, bluegrass, and all the different versions of what we do today, you can trace our language back to those four things. I would make an argument that, you know, we wouldn't have rock and roll without originally having the hoedown 400 years ago, or we wouldn't have rock and roll if it wasn't for the blues, or we wouldn't have rock and roll if it wasn't for the spiritual and ragtime.
And certainly not Gershwin.
Exactly. I mean, it's really an amazing phenomenon, and it can be traced. And the musical language is there for all of us to enjoy. And the interesting thing about American music is that it was largely created with the violin as central to its development. We just don't know that today because we don't teach that in the conservatories. Along around 1920s, 1930s, the violin was still very popular in popular music. Mm-hmm. Then it started to go by the wayside. Guitar largely replaced it in our culture. The guitars started to be made much better.
So they would last because they...
They would last. They would fall apart.
Yeah.
Also, they benefited from the industrial age of metal. All of a sudden, there were banjos and guitars made with some metal resonators. And this happened all during the same time as what I call the age of specialization in American music, where people started to market music completely different now because of radio and records, as well as the conservatories. This all happened at the same time, and people started to concentrate on one thing rather than being an all-around musician. And Americans were basically all-around musicians for hundreds of years before that. Some of my very favorite fiddlers, say in bluegrass music from the 1940s, almost all of them came from playing jazz. And you fast forward today and you would say jazz and bluegrass in the same sentence and people's, you know, heads would do a 180. Like, what? That's impossible. But that was actually how it developed. That's how it happened. So these are a lot of the stories and background information that inform my method.
That's fantastic. I'd like to ask you to perform a spiritual now as a demonstration of how it sounds on the violin.
It's a beautiful quality that the spiritual gives. And I think for a method of learning, it's very instructive because we think of classical music as just very deeply felt and passionate music. Well, in the American scene, that's our spirituals and our blues. The blues can be performed more roughly and ragged, but the spirituals are supposed to be sung and played beautifully. You want to hear the heart in that music. And it's for longing for better times. And for a lot of people, a lot of our people, is longing for freedom.
Well, here it is, Deep River. Thank you. a classic American spiritual performed in a most beautiful and soulful manner by our guest Mark O'Connor with Melissa Tong at the piano, Deep River. Thank you very much for that. It's really amazing the amount of research you've put into your work, but also the perspective that you have that is really groundbreaking. I think that your ability to truly bring together the melting pot of American musical history in this way is utterly unique.
Yeah, I grew up wishing that things weren't so compartmentalized in our scene. I remember, you know, telling the jazzers that I played bluegrass and they made fun of it. And then I would tell, you know, the jazz people that I loved classical music, and they said, well, that's going to ruin your jazz playing. And on and on. I mean, it's like everybody was like fighting each other and going, no, it's all music. It's all connected.
Did you meet anyone who got you early on?
Very few. Now, my teachers, you know, Benny Thomason understood. Stefan Grappelli understood. We called our ingredients secret ingredients. Like we, you know, like with Stefan Grappelli, he was my teacher, and he had his secret ingredients. And that's why I was gravitated towards these men, because they embodied what I wanted to be. You know, when I listen to Stefan Grappelli and look at his history of music, you know, he's got classical training. He's playing jazz music. He's introduced gypsy music through his partner Django Reinhardt.
Yes, yes.
He works as a tango musician because the Argentinian tango was exploding in 1920s Paris when he was young. And then, of course, he's from Paris, so he's got the French stuff, the French Art Cafe, that inflected his music. And then when he started teaching me, we had two those things in common. We had classical music and jazz, but my secret ingredients were different than his. Mine included the blues and bluegrass and Western swing. And he didn't know much about those.
Well, he must have gone crazy over you.
He loved it, though. I mean, he just loved it. One time when we were playing together, someone came up to him and said, you're playing with Mark O'Connor. Do you play country music or fiddle music, you know? And Stefan Grappelli says, I do not play the country music. I do not ride the horse.
He did play country music. It was just a different country.
Right.
Yes. Well, there's a piece, a Shaker hymn, Simple Gifts, that I first learned because of Aaron Copland's setting of it. Because being a Jewish kid, I didn't know from many hymns at all, especially a Shaker hymn. But the simplicity and the beauty of Copland's setting of it, it was what opened me up to investigating and looking at that. Would you talk about Simple Gifts, which is part of an incredible tradition in America that goes back, what, 400 years, is it, or 500? Or it's long.
The Shakers came over... you know, in the 1700s from Europe. And one of their, I guess, processes was to compose music within their community to try to, you know, get new members. And so they had to compose some really good music to get people to join up, you know. And it's a song. It was most likely a dance. The lyrics... to a verse go like this. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we shan't be ashamed. To turn will be our delight, till by turning, we come round right. Hmm. And this piece became a staple of American classical music through Copland. And Copland's greatest themes, most recognizable themes, happen to be from our traditional cultures. Mm-hmm. But what Copland was able to do was, and what Dvorak did, was to identify traditional pieces of music that represents our classical music.
Well, that's a perfect cue to hear Simple Gifts. ¶¶ That's our guest, Mark O'Connor, performing Simple Gifts, an 1840s Shaker hymn. It's amazing. I believe that music contains divinity.
Yes. I was looking for ways to identify music with nature, with divinity. And I think music is human nature. I don't think that we can be separated from it. You know, some people claim they're tone deaf. I never believed that. Not for a second. It's just circumstance, just environment. You take that person, that child, you know, put them around more music, and things would have been different.
I so agree with you, of course. It's something I've said before about the separation of our culture right now. A lot of it has to do with the lack of arts education, that we've lost our common ground. And what you were doing is bringing it together on so many levels. It's so fascinating to me because everything turns out ultimately to be about the same thing. About connecting one way or another.
I met President Obama recently, just briefly, and I was thinking of what will I say? I've got, you know, basically 10 seconds. Hmm. And I said, music in the schools, I'm an advocate for that. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he said, wouldn't that be wonderful? You know?
Yes.
Right? But I'm hoping that, you know, in all the incredible stuff he has to deal with, maybe he'll remember that, music in schools, mm-hmm. because music is different than anything else. Because it brings people together.
Right.
It's a social form. And right now, especially with things like the iPhone and the internet, we're getting isolated further and further.
Yeah.
We need to commune. We need to be able to hang out with each other. And so those moments, I think, those opportunities to bring the instruments together, bring generations together, is really a big inspiration for the method.
I'd like to ask you to play one more piece from the method, a blues piece that is something that you have composed, and I'm glad to hear something that you've created on our program today.
One of the first people that I associated with rock and roll and blues was Bo Diddley, and I got to play with him early on my television show called The American Music Shop back in 1990. and he was one of our guests, and I was the band leader and director. And so we were rehearsing in front of the cameras. The audience was not in their seats yet, but there was a lot of people around, and of course the whole band was on stage. We finished the first song, and he turned back at me and he said, "Son, you play a fine violin." And I was playing, you know, blues licks, and, you know, here's this great architect of rock and roll, an African-American musician who made it all the way to the top. And he's, you know, he's relating to the blues licks that I'm playing, you know, this white kid.
From Seattle
on the fiddle playing his music, because I was very nervous. I was thinking, well, I don't want to like mess up his tunes. But we already had several guitar players on stage. He plays guitar. And so I thought, well, I could, you know, play a guitar, I guess, on his tunes. But I wanted to play with him. And then after we did his second tune rehearsal, he turned back to me again. He said, "Can I ask you something?" I said, "Yes, sir. What would it be?" He said, "Could I hold your violin?" And he came over to me and outstretched with his arms like he was going to receive a baby. I put the violin in his arms, and he started crying. Huh. It was one of those great moments for me that brought the whole world together of how important music is and how hard and how struggle-filled our history is with music, making it all better. He found a way to make his music heal the wounds that he must have suffered as a young violin student. Mm-hmm. Probably people telling him that he would never amount to anything because he's African-American violinist. In the 1920s, they didn't want to, you know, nobody wanted to see an African-American.
Yeah, it would have been impossible, practically impossible. Yeah.
And he showed it. He showed it to the world that he could invent something. He was creative. And he created rock and roll along with a few of his colleagues. And so that message for me is just amazing. And the violin was once again central to his realization that music could save his soul and put his name in the history books forever.
Well, please play this this blues piece apropos of that. You've called it In the Cluster Blues.
Yes, I a very little known fact, but I have cluster headaches. It's a really bad form of a migraine. And I think about the pain that I have to go through, you know, sometimes daily, sometimes multiple times a day. Then I'll be at a stretch for, I'll be fine for a few months. But I think about music and healing, and when I get rid of the pain, you know, it makes music even sweeter. So I think about that when I play the blues and about overcoming great obstacles in your life, playing through the pain, and then getting to another place that's much better.
Here is In the Cluster Blues by our guest, Mark O'Connor.
Thank you.
Mark O'Connor performing in the Cluster Blues with Melissa Tong at the piano. Having heard your description of what the title means made me listen to that piece very differently. It's extraordinary what can be expressed in the few notes that are part of a scale.
Yeah, I think a lot of people wonder, what does a little white kid from Seattle know about the blues, you know? But it's all about language.
Yeah.
And all of our lives are interconnected. We, you know, we're all looking for different versions of freedom. Nobody's ever satisfied with who they are and what their place is. And I think music historically has helped us get to a better place. You know, that feeling that, you know, when you listen to your favorite piece of music and it transports you, as a musician, we can do that, you know, with the snap of the finger. Mm-hmm. And that's why I would love all children to be able to play music, because a lot of them could improve their lives when they would have this vehicle to create, to communicate, when sometimes words are not enough. The feelings can come out through sound and through playing together. And that's really what the blues means to all of us.
Listening to you reminds me of some of the ideals of George Gershwin. He had publishing companies that he started. One was called New World Music, and the other was called New Dawn Music. And I've never figured out or found out the genesis of those names. Sadly, when I knew Ira Gershwin, I never thought to ask him about it. But to me, it is clearly he was saying, this is a vision. This is something for the world. New World Music. Pretty powerful.
George Gershwin is, we refer to him as the great American of all the musicians. And he's probably my biggest inspiration. And I know he's one of your biggest inspirations as well.
Well, I think that a good way to tie this up musically would be to do a Gershwin piece that is one of the most universally beloved compositions by George Gershwin called Summertime.
George Gershwin is certainly an inspiration, and I love Summertime.
Well, I'm honored to perform it with you.
Thank you.
Well, that's a wow for me, Mark, to do that. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your extraordinary talent, your vision, and for sharing your knowledge and your time.
Thank you, Michael. I really enjoyed it. It was great to be able to play all these American tunes. I loved it.
Me too.
You've been listening to Song Travels with host Michael Feinstein and his guest, Mark O'Connor. Song Travels is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio, and is recorded at Hirsch Studios in New York City, with post-production in the Elaine T. Freeman Suite at ETV Radio in Columbia, South Carolina. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Duke Marcos, assistant recording engineer Andrew Shire, mastering engineer David Mitchell, production manager Grant Jackson, production assistant Laura Hunsberger. The executive producer is Kobe Hennessy. The executive in charge is Linda O'Brien. Special thanks to Anya Grundman, director and executive producer of NPR Music. We love to hear from you. Our email address is songtravels@scetv.org. Support for Song Travels comes from NPR member stations and NPR. Support for NPR comes from NPR contributors, which include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence of poetry in American culture. PoetryFoundation.org. This is NPR.